So I don't know about you, Anna. I think this pro-democracy transition that's going on in Myanmar may be getting deadly serious.
Mm-hmm.
We've watched incremental change for quite a long time, but over the weekend, very serious history was made.
Quite a moment.
Indeed. Over the weekend, pro-democracy activist and Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi was elected to Myanmar's fledgling new parliament. That's a taste of the reaction on the streets. Suu Kyi's supporters reacting to news of her win. After years of house arrest, Suu Kyi appears poised to finally step into a role of real power in the country. And as North Africa and the Middle East have erupted in revolutionary fervor reminiscent of Iran 1979 or Russia 1991 or even France 1789, Myanmar's transition from the total control of a military junta to what seems to be an emerging democratic revolution quietly reminiscent of nothing in recent memory. Is it a new model for a pro-democracy revolution? Joining us are Suzanne DiMaggio, Vice President for Global Policy Programs at the Asia Society. Welcome to the program once again, Suzanne.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Sure. And Robert Lieber joins us, Professor of Government and International Affairs at Georgetown University. His latest book is entitled Power and Willpower in the American Future, Why the U.S. is Not Destined to Decline. Robert, welcome.
Good morning.
So, Suzanne, let's start with the developments over the weekend. And, you know, first of all, would you agree that this is a deadly serious transition, that we've reached a point of no return here?
There's no question that the changes underway in Myanmar are real. Whether or not they're going to have staying power, that's the real question that everyone's looking at now. But given the dramatic events that happened yesterday, and not to mention other reforms that are taking place, not only in the political sphere, but the economic sphere, it's looking like this is something serious.
Robert Lieber, as Americans and as observers in the West, we often embrace very quickly the well-known 1776 model for revolution, throwing off the old regime, a colonial regime in the case of America, a war, and then some sort of democratic transition, which seems as though that's going on in Egypt. A lot of the Arab Spring has had that sort of violent kind of model. Do you think we do it at our peril and miss maybe some of the subtler changes that also result in democracy in places like Myanmar?
I think that's right. You don't have powdered democracy, you add water, and presto, you have a democracy. There hasn't been enough attention to the fact that democracy is more than being about elections, for instance. It requires rule of law, it requires tolerance, minority rights, the right of an opposition to organize, an entire set of both civil and political freedoms. Democracy is really about two things, and it's been seen that way for centuries. One aspect is popular sovereignty. That's what people out in the streets, the overthrow of Mubarak and so forth, is all about. But the other half of that is liberty. And at the time of the American Revolution, for example, throughout discussions among political philosophers over the ages, those two ideas have sometimes been in conflict. We accept the two as intimately related, even nearly the same thing here. But in the Middle East, that's not the case at all. You've got increasing popular sovereignty, but issues of liberty are very much up in the air.
And the question is, do you want to lead with the rule of law or lead with the liberty in the streets, which is certainly the model in Egypt? Suzanne DiMaggio, what is the evidence that the junta is interested in actual rule of law? And we must presume that Aung San Suu Kyi would not step into a government that was simply a figurehead.
Well, I think one of the most potent examples that this is moving in a new direction is new laws that have come into place that allow people to assemble. There's a greater extent of freedom of speech, a greater extent to organize politically. And I think now, having been in Myanmar recently and witnessing it for myself, the fact that people are able to speak openly, about political ideas and political aspirations is something that we just haven't seen for decades. The fact that Aung San Suu Kyi and her party, the National League for Democracy, and don't forget the NLD up until a little over a year ago was an illegal entity. The military government deemed it as an illegal entity. So the fact now that they were able to run an election that seems to be have been relatively free and fair, not only run, but actually win what looks like to be the majority of the seats, is fairly dramatic. Other developments in the area of law, rule of law, are unfolding every day. New laws in the area of economics, investment laws that are making the ability to invest in the country without a partner, a Burmese partner, is also something new. So this is an example of a very isolated country that is opening.
And, you know, there's strong incentives for Burma to become an economic powerhouse to compete with Southeast Asia and then, of course, China, which brings me to the huge elephant in the room in Asia and really in the world if we talk about pro-democracy. If China was interested legitimately in moving towards a more democratic system, would the model they'd be more likely to embrace be Tahrir Square, Robert Lieber? Or would it be this development of a kind of negotiated incremental change going on in Myanmar?
Knows. The key point is that while at a distance, say, Asian countries or Middle Eastern countries or Arab Muslim countries may look more similar than not from halfway around the world, each of them is very individual. They each have their own path dependency, their own histories, their own, in some case, internal tribal, regional, or even religious differences. And it's very hard to generalize about that. Even on the case of Myanmar, according to today's paper, while Aung San Suu Kyi's party won almost all of the seats up for a vote yesterday, that was only 40 to 45 seats out of a total of 664.
Right.
The regime controls the rest right now, and there won't be really major national elections until the end of 2015. So there's a lot of popular enthusiasm, and I would bet that the great bulk of the population wants that kind of change. Much the same may be true in large parts of the Middle East. And in a place like Tunisia, a genuine democratic transformation really does seem to be underway in the way that we understand these things. But elsewhere in the region, it's a much more dicey proposition.
Robert Lieber, professor of government and international affairs at Georgetown, author of Power and Willpower in the American Future, Why the U.S. is Not Destined to Decline, and Suzanne DiMaggio, vice president for global policy programs at the Asia Society. Thanks to both of you.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.